Attention, listener. In honor of the Thanksgiving holiday and large volumes of traffic, we are giving you a choice. You can be scanned and listen to the podcast, or you can submit to a systematic pat-down beating by large, hairy TSA employees.
I'll take the beating!
Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Kim Jong-il.
And I'm a large, hairy TSA employee. Happy Thanksgiving, Ken.
You too, Ron.
And it is traditional at this time of year to pardon a turkey, so we're just going to go right ahead and pardon this podcast.
Thank you very much.
What happened this week? Anything other than our sending an aircraft carrier and a battle group to North Korea to possibly start World War III?
Well, I think you're burying the lead. Actually, Bristol Palin finished third in Dancing with the Stars.
I think there's going to have to be some investigation here, because if Joe Miller has a case in Alaska about these write-in ballots, I think Bristol has a case here, because she was clearly the most popular. All right, maybe she wasn't the greatest dancer, but what does it have to do with this?
Obviously, the Kennedy-Nixon battle, that was completely legitimate. It was completely legitimate.
No stolen votes
in Chicago.
No
stolen votes. Bush Gore, no, that was fine.
That
Florida.
Was a problem.
Exactly.
Yeah.
No. But this Palin thing is just a disgrace.
Oh, it stinks to high heaven.
Absolutely.
Now, but here's my other question. If the fix wasn't in, why wasn't Sarah Palin in the audience?
Because she is now engaging in a book tour that seems to be, once again, making her the most talked-about politician in the land.
Isn't it amazing she's had time to write yet another book in such a short time?
Just as the right wing never understood Obama, they just thought he was a pretender, that he had no experience, that he was all rhetoric. That's how the left feels about Sarah Palin. They just don't understand
the
appeal.
They completely overlook, all the accomplishments that Sarah Palin really actually has had.
Well, but no, it's not a question of accomplishment. What accomplishments did Barack Obama have going into the 2008 presidential race?
Well, in talking in terms of things like, say, his education, service in the state legislature, service in the United States Senate.
But that's not what the message was of 2010.
No, you're absolutely right. That was not the message. And in terms of the message, I think you are right about the two sides failing to adequately understand or comprehend what it is that the champions for each side have to offer. But here's the irony. The irony is that Sarah Palin is right now the only well-known potential candidate for president on the Republican side. For better or for worse, who is not at least tied with Barack Obama in the polls. And yet she is by far the most popular among Republicans. Now that is a potential problem for the Republicans, that their most popular figure, the person who at this point, you hear some Republican analysts say, gee, if she gets in, she wins Iowa and New Hampshire, how are you going to stop her? She's going to win South Carolina. She's just going to keep right on going. And then we have nominated the person who, unlike the rest of our candidates, is deemed unacceptable by a majority
that
of Americans.
That is the establishment Republican position. And the Bushies have talked about that. I think either Cheney or Rove have talked about that.
Well, Barbara Bush said, I hope she stays in Alaska.
Right. Except she quit 2 years ago, so I don't know what she'd be doing there.
Well, that's exactly right.
The quitting
the governorship of Alaska, by the way, is perhaps the one thing that sort of sets apart Sarah Palin from other people that we have seen in American politics at this level. She really is redefining what it means to be a national political figure. To quit your governorship halfway through, to say it's much more important for me to be doing something else, which was clearly going on television and making a ton of money, for someone to be known for the exploits, shall we say, of her family, and to be known for these books that she's associated with and doing book tours, and really having no pretense to wanting to be part of a government.
Right, that's exactly. There's nothing, whatever you say about Sarah Palin, there's nothing phony about it. It just seems like, this is what I am, take it or leave it. I don't even care if you leave it. And there are people who are just saying that, the politics that we've seen for decades in the past, the establishment way of doing things, that's not the way we want to do it anymore.
But here's the problem. If you get elected president, it is still expected. Oh, maybe this is going to change too in the Palin era, but it is still expected that you would move to Washington, live in the White House, and govern the country. She doesn't seem to have any interest in any of those things.
Well, and we're already deciding that she's running for president. She may not decide.
I don't see how she stops at this point, because it's all been a big tease. But at some juncture, she risks everything that she has built up for herself if she pushes it and pushes it, as she continues to do on a weekly basis, and then somehow says, but I'm not actually going to run for president, unless she is hoping that she doesn't have to run. And somehow the party will turn to her at the convention. That, I think, would be a mistake, because all the mechanics dictate that whoever wins the primaries is going to have the delegates and they're going to nominate that person.
Of all the prospective Republicans for 2012, she is somebody who probably has to make her intentions known the latest. In other words, she doesn't have to be like a Mitch Daniels, for example, who has to get known in Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina,
even
the early
Indiana.
States. In Indiana, exactly. Even in the Daniels household.
There is a very interesting group of Republican governors. Mitch Daniels, very serious governor of Indiana, guy who was part of the Reagan Revolution back in the 80s, kind of a bridge between those two eras. There's Haley Barbour, who, as we've many times said, you know, is kind of a cartoony figure in a lot of ways, but is very well respected among governors, very well respected in Washington.
Why do you say cartoony?
Because he sounds so much a caricature.
Because I think he's smart.
Yes.
He's probably the
savvy,
probably make the best Republican national chairman, even though it's been there, done that already.
No, but now we're talking about a television show, the presidential contest. And it is a television show. And he is going to come across, I think, as too much of a caricature of a Southern governor, particularly the way he talks. But there are others as well. There is a groundswell of interest in Chris Christie from New Jersey. You would not think that he was a particularly dashing television show figure for the presidency, but there is this groundswell. You'll still hear people talking about Bobby Jindal. And, of course, we still have Mitt Romney, another former Republican governor, and a very serious guy with a very serious resume who would seem, by the more conventional standards, to be an obvious frontrunner for 2012. He's still out. So we've got a lot of other people.
Right?
Yeah, I've really have a hard time taking Tim Pawlenty seriously, even though, you know, I think on profile and in a lot of ways he might be the ideal sort of Republican figure. But like Mitch Daniels and some of these other fellows, he's got an awful lot of people he has to introduce to himself, and he does not have what I would call an obvious calling card. You know, a Minnesota miracle or something that happened in the state that could be seen as propelling him to the national stage other than pure ambition.
And also the fact that he stood up to the Democrats who run the Minnesota legislature. He could talk about how he blocked their programs to make Minnesota into more of a socialist state than it already is. No,
he has that other problem, which is like Mitt Romney in Massachusetts, he has had years of governing a state that is on the left side of the ledger and is perceived widely that way, particularly in the South, and they're not going to be looking to him for their champion.
Although historically, when you think of Republican nominees, you think of Reagan and Nixon and McCain and Dole and the first President Bush, all of them had run and lost for the nomination before they were finally elected or nominated, and of course
that would qualify Romney. Five or six things that you could say about Romney: the access to money, the fact that he's more of an establishment candidate, the fact that he has stepped out of the way for another candidate, in this case McCain. He's really done a lot of the things which, back over history, position somebody to be the Republican nominee. But it's just that it's a sprung mechanism.
It's also a different time. The Republican Party may have changed, too. We don't know what 2009, 2010 said about the new Republican Party for 2012. So the old way, which seemingly would benefit a candidate like Romney, that may not work in 2012. I mean, again, we're talking about 2012. We're still fighting over some of the results of 2010 that have just been announced this week.
That's right. Now, we're up to 63 House seats net for the Republicans. Right. That is a very large figure.
Which is close to my prediction. I predicted plus four.
Be fair, Ken. You predicted that the Republicans would take over the House.
Yes, but
you did not see
close to the numbers. The Jim Oberstars, the people I never thought would lose.
But Ken, quick question: how many more races are uncalled?
Well, let me just say that this week we have three that is announced. In Texas, 27, Solomon Ortiz conceded defeat to Republican Blake Farenthold. Dan Maffei in New York's 25th district around Syracuse, he conceded to Anne Marie Burkle, so that comes to 63. Jim Costa in California's 20th district did hold on. I think he's a 2 or 3 term incumbent. He's a Democrat. He did hold on. Jerry McNerney in California, who seems to have a pretty insurmountable lead.
Yeah, if Costa got through, it looked like McNerney would get through too, because of the patterns of the
that hasn't been called yet. But in New York's first congressional district,
Tim Bishop
on Suffolk County, the eastern tip of Long Island, Tim Bishop is like maybe 12 votes against his Republican rival. It's not over yet. That's the one seat that has yet to be called. Remember, 2 years ago at this point, we were still fighting over Minnesota, and that would go on for another 8 months.
Yes, and we are still fighting about Minnesota.
Another recount,
again,
right?
This time, with another recount, this time in the governor's race, Mark Dayton against Tom Emmer. We don't know what the result there will be, although it appears Dayton has a pretty healthy lead, healthier than anyone else had, or healthier than either candidate ever had in the Senate race 2 years
ago.
That
was triple digits. This is 8,770 votes. The recount starts Monday. It has to be certified, I think, by December 14th. Most people people feel that Emmer does not have a shot, but given that it was one half of 1% of the total, he's entitled to the automatic recount. But few people think that Dayton is going to be denied the governorship.
So we really are down to a very minimal number. The other question I alluded to earlier was Joe Miller in Alaska, who has gone to court. We will probably get some kind of a recount there in Alaska. But the big issue there is, do all the write-ins for Lisa Murkowski have to be perfectly spelled?
Well, they say that right now she has about an 8,000-vote lead. If they toss out all the questionable write-ins for Lisa Murkowski, she would still have a 2,500-vote lead. But it was interesting that Jim DeMint, the conservative alternative in the Senate, he is sending out fundraising appeals for Joe Miller's appeal.
Now, that, I think, has more to do with the internal battles of the Senate,
absolutely,
really, than anything else. What he is saying is, I don't want Lisa Murkowski to come back here and be restored. She had a minor position in the leadership as, well, I believe it was vice chairman of the Senate Republican Conference. And she was also, and this is not a minor position, she was the ranking member for the Republican Party on the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee, which is an extraordinarily important committee for Alaska and for other states, and particularly in the West. So he is essentially saying, I don't want her to come back here and be restored to her full status. I'm still backing Joe Miller, and it's casting some doubt on her legitimacy as a member of the Republican conference in the Senate.
But if you remember, not too long ago, although it was 1999, but that was yesterday for some of us, but Robert Smith, Bob Smith of New Hampshire, quit the Republican Party. He was running for president, ran as an independent, left the Republican Party, and then when the chairman of the Senate Environmental Committee, John Chafee, died, he immediately switched back to the Republicans and assumed the chairmanship there. So,
but in that case, he had not run against a Republican for a Senate seat.
Yes, but he quit the party.
Yes, he did. But everyone understood that Bob Smith was taking a little walk. He was taking a little absence. He was making a sort of extraterrestrial expedition out, yes, to running for president,
right,
which no one ever took seriously other than Bob Smith.
Not sure about that either. But
so, you mean you're not sure Bob Smith
took it seriously?
Yes,
yeah.
So there was a certain amount of evidence to that effect. But I'm just saying,
right,
he had not run against another candidate who was blessed by his colleagues in the Senate for that very Senate seat. Lisa Murkowski's on some unusual ground here. I think they're going to welcome her back. I think certainly Mitch McConnell and the rest of the regular leaders, other than Jim DeMint, will welcome her back and want her vote and want her input and be glad to have her, and maybe glad to have her rather than Joe Miller, quite frankly.
Two things that Lisa Murkowski brings. One, she is the only person publicly standing up to Sarah Palin. She said, lack of intellectual curiosity, the fact that she gave up on Alaska. Everybody else in the Republican establishment is doing kid gloves with Sarah Palin.
You bet.
Not Lisa Murkowski.
Kid gloves are open embrace.
Lisa Murkowski is also saying that I intend to work across the aisle with Democrats to get things done.
Ooh, wait a minute.
I know.
Ooh,
that's not
what... That sounds downright bipartisan. Who does she think she is? Link Chafee?
Certainly she doesn't sound like Jim DeMint, who said, I'd rather have, 20...
30.
30.
Let's be fair.
Okay.
Let's be fair. Jim said he would rather have 30 Republicans he could count on.
Right. Then 60 Earl Inspectors, which
then,
I understand.
Then 60 Earl Inspectors.
Right.
Okay, so this is the election that never stops, and we're going to have these lawsuits, but it does appear that the Senate is beginning to settle down into the 100 senators we'll actually be dealing with, which, of course, pushes you and me to talk about the next round of Senate elections. And when we look at 2012, it looks like we might get some rematches from 2006, when a lot of the members of the Democratic majority got elected, including Jim Webb of Virginia, who beat George Allen, who was the son of the famous football coach and had a couple of terms in the Senate, and was being touted as a presidential candidate.
Measuring the drapes, we said.
Back in 2006, until one day when he had a fall from grace.
So welcome. Let's give a welcome to Makaka here. Welcome to America and the real world of Virginia.
It seems clear that George Allen was going to be a leading Republican contender until that breakdown, and although he lost to Webb narrowly. But in 2012, of the 33 Senate seats that are up, 23 are held by Democrats. John Cornyn of the NRSC, the National Republican Senatorial Committee, has said from the beginning that this is a two-cycle effort to regain control of the Senate, and it looks like the numbers certainly benefit the Republicans in 2012.
It's going to have to be a huge Democratic wave year to save the Senate. Otherwise, if it's even in an average year with an average mix of Republican and Democratic wins and losses, all these first-term senators who are coming up for the first time, they're going to be vulnerable. A lot of them are going to be vulnerable. It would take something of a miracle to preserve them all, and therefore, because the Republicans have virtually no vulnerables on the ballot in 2012.
Well, John Ensign, maybe.
John Ensign, but look at Nevada. even if John Ensign has real problems, he's going to lose in the primary, and they'll put somebody else up.
That's what happened with Governor Jim Gibbons.
Exactly, and I think that that might very well be the case in Nevada. If, well, on the other hand, he's gotten over his
Sharon problems. Engel, by the way, is talking about...
Of course she is, but I doubt very much that she will win again. I think that the Tea Party phenomenon will continue, but it will be a different phenomenon in 2012, and it will not be catching people unawares in the way that it did in 2010.
Certainly with Sharon Engel's nomination.
Exactly. So I don't really see even Nevada as being an easy pickup for the Democrats. First question, who runs? Who's the Democratic nominee? So I really don't see a lot of Republican vulnerables in 2012.
Olympia Snowe probably could very well lose the primary to a conservative challenger. And that's one seat I think the Republicans
that would
should be nervous
considered,
about.
That's right. They'd be nervous there, but only if Olympia Snowe loses, and she hasn't lost yet. I would be a little surprised if 2 years from now the tide is still running so strongly in the Tea Party direction in the state of Maine that she were to lose that Republican nomination.
The new governor of Maine is a Tea Party candidate.
Which is a big reason why I don't think Party trend will still be running. I think he's going to be a problem for them in Maine, and I think that'll help Olympia Snowe. So in the end, I think the Republicans stand an excellent chance of two cycles in a row, 2010, 2012, in which they lose no seats in the Senate. And that would almost automatically mean that enough seats came their way from the other side that they were the new majority.
We can't let anybody enjoy their Thanksgiving until we remind them that the Congress does come back next week to take care of some unfinished business.
Oh.
And that includes the censure vote, which may be a formality of Charlie Rangel.
What does he have to endure? Does he have to stand down in the well?
He does.
While the vote is taken?
And the speaker will read off the charges. That's Rangel, but there is obviously a delay in the, not Tom delay, and we'll talk about that in a second, but there's also a delay in the Maxine Waters ethics case.
Yes, Maxine Waters was supposed to be brought up on her list of charges before the ethics panel this coming week on November 29th. That has now been at least delayed. And there is some school of thought that this is about to be deep six, that she is going to reach some sort of an agreement with the committee that is going to obviate the necessity for a further proceeding. Now, maybe she's getting the message from what they did to Charlie Rangel. Maybe there has been some new evidence brought forward, as has been suggested, that might be exculpatory in nature, which I think is a good thing. For her.
I would say maybe there's less of a case against Maxine Waters than there was
against
Charlie Rangel.
That would be the nature of exculpatory. Right. And so it's possible that this is going to go away. I think that with the punishment of Charlie Rangel, who has been much, much more of a media focus in all of his ethics troubles, partly because they were first brought up in the New York Times, and partly because he is just a much better known national figure.
Former chairman of Ways and Means.
Than Maxine Waters. Perhaps the Waters case is going to go away. What is the latest with Tom DeLay's trial in Austin, Texas?
Well, he is, again, this is going back to 2002, the misuse of campaign funds for political purposes. Apparently the jury has gotten its instructions, and perhaps a verdict is within days. The DeLay people, of course, say this is all politics. And, of course, at the same time, they're trying it in Travis County, which is not the most friendly place in the world to be if you're Tom DeLay. But we expect a decision perhaps in the next week or so.
But we don't expect the lame duck, while it will censure Charlie Rangel and it will postpone any action on Maxine Waters, we don't expect this lame duck to tackle very many of the other issues that it has before it. Presumably, they will pass some kind of a continuing resolution to keep the government functioning, but no real appropriations bills. Presumably, they may do something with regard to unemployment benefits, but there's no guarantee that that will be enacted before this Congress goes home for Christmas. And they may take up Don't Ask, Don't Tell. They may take up the Disclose bill to make transparent these new contributions that are flooding into congressional races. And they could also take up the extension of the Bush-era tax cuts. It's also possible they won't do any of those things. And they'll be here right up to Christmas Eve not doing it as the Democrats try to force the Republicans into these votes and as the Republicans, particularly in the Senate, block the votes.
Well, one thing that it looks like they're not going to do, and you could thank John Kyle, you could thank the Republican will, or you could say, well, look, we could discuss it in the 112th Congress, is the New START Treaty, which President Obama and Vice President Biden have been saying is crucial to our national security, why it has to be passed in this lame duck, why it wasn't passed earlier in the year when they had the votes. I don't know. And of course, the Democrats...
Well, partly because there's been a lot of talk about pushing it back and let's see more. And John Kyle wanting to broker a deal to get a lot of new money spent on modernizing the American nuclear arsenal.
Which he's getting anyway. He's still getting
which
that.
Which he is getting. But now there are other questions. And clearly now the Republicans want to push it into next year when they have more votes in the Senate.
And it's still, I mean, we're not talking about a majority here. You need to get 67 votes to pass this.
67.
And that's, so that's all 53 Democratic senators, plus, if my math is right, 14 Republicans. That's going to be a tough hill to climb.
Extremely tough. And it will be interesting to see here how the Republic reacts when this results in a change in our relationship with Russia, a change in our verification ability for other nuclear powers around the world, and whether or not that is perceived as being a good national security policy move, or if the Republicans have some other pound of flesh they want to extract before they allow New START to go through. Perhaps that's their real objective here.
Well, we do go into the Thanksgiving holiday with the uncertainty what's going on with Korea. North Korea shelling of the South Korea island once again shows the limitations to what President Obama and the United States can do. You can threaten sanctions all you want. You could send an aircraft carrier there and make a show of force. But ultimately, North Korea seems to listen to nobody. And you just wonder, we could always talk about all the treaties you want to think and all the carrot and stick approach. But ultimately, it's hard to make a case that anything is working in this region of the world.
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
Wait, I have more to say. Okay, you can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week if you survive the TSA scanning process for It's All Politics from NPR.
Happy Thanksgiving, Ron.
Ken, happy Thanksgiving to you.